Today on The Grave Talks, Order of Exorcism Part 2, as we continue our conversation with Timothy Earle. Timothy Earle is an employee of the Advent International Order of Exorcists, reports directly to Archbishop James Cloud, chief exorcist. His adventure began back in 1997 when he began collecting EVPs with no ill intent. Nevertheless, things moved fast into a very different direction after his wife was subjected to a demonic assault. His life has been profiled in a number of documentaries and television series since. Today we learn what it takes to be an exorcist and what his life is like going down that path on The Grave Talks.
You know, there's a lot of depression associated with this.
Sure. You'd almost have to be in that state, I would think, to, you know, you could be that worn down, which so many of us get that way just with life, that I would assume that someone who is already suffering from depression, from in mental illness as well, are those people bigger targets for something to come in and possess someone? Does someone have to ask? Does someone have to do something to invite something like this in to attach to themselves? Or does it just kind of sneak in when you least expect it?
It can sneak in when you least expect it. I had a case where I, good Protestant family, in a city not too far away from me, goes active in the church, goes to the church. Husband was a youth minister. I mean, the very stereotypical Bible Belt family.
Sure.
And they were also prominent. He was a president at the local bank. She was a socialite. You know, I think if they probably married into money or, you know, had money the old fashioned way, but I'm not certain. Anyway, they started having ended up being demonic activity in their home, and they were being attacked. We never got to the root of why. Sometimes you just don't get a why. Mm-hmm. Then you just have to, you know, be ready to live with that. But the thing that she shared with me after it was all said and done, you know, she sent me a letter. And she said that the realization that this was even real immediately outcast her from the rest of society. That is, she could remember, she shared that she was sitting at a busy traffic intersection at a red light, and she's looking around, and she is not part of what's happening right there at that moment, because now she has a knowledge of what everybody has dismissed, you know, and this knowledge of this all life, the spiritual life and the dangers thereof, just separates her from even being able to socialize.
Mm-hmm.
Her into PTSD. She had to, go to professional counseling. And my understanding is she's still doing it today because, you know, her whole belief system's upended.
Yeah.
So, it's a life shocker. I remember that. I'll share this one story with you real quick. You know, people reach out to me all the time. Hey, I want to get involved, or hey, can you take me ghost hunting? I even took a TV show ghost hunting a couple of times, actually. There's a one social worker reached out, and one of her children, I actually think it was a young adult, but with Down syndrome, was really into ghost hunting, wanted to go ghost hunting, was asking me to take them ghost hunting. And I just simply responded, okay, great. What happens if we actually see a ghost? How's your young man going to react?
Yeah.
And she spiced back, never mind. So, you know, you got to think it through. Everybody wants to see a ghost until they actually see a ghost and have that experience.
It's not like riding Splash Mountain. It's a serious thing where there could be real effects, real outcomes to doing it.
Yeah, there is, and especially for somebody doing what I do. We get attacked all the time. When I have something coming, a case coming, even before I know it, we'll start having paranormal activity. I walk into the living room, the chandelier swinging, you know. We start seeing shadow people. And I'll know that I'll be getting a phone call shortly. So those are actually topical. That type of activity is really easy for me to interact with, because, you know, they're not really affecting me. They're just, I'm been there, done that. You know,
is it trying to taunt you when it's doing things like that? Like, yeah, you think you're going to go help? Look, what we're already here. We're already doing this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of it is feeling me out, seeing what I am, what I'm capable of. Mm-hmm. Some of it's trying to scare me off before I can do it. But, it's hasn't worked in the past, and maybe it should have at times. I'll be honest with you. There's been a couple of cases that I shouldn't have gone on.
But, yeah.
So
let me ask you this. You had brought up earlier that, you work with some psychologists, and especially when you're trying to evaluate, is this person mentally ill or is there a possession going on? How on board are some of those psychologists where they do the evaluation and they say, yeah, we don't think this person has any sort of disorder going on? Do you have ones that are like, I think possession is the answer here, considering they're coming from a world of medicine and that sort of, you know, viewpoint of science that these things are, you know, it's some sort of malady with the brain.
So I won't get they're possessed. That no licensed doctor would ever do that. They would be, you know, right out of town.
Sure.
So I'm not going to get it possessed. Now, I've personally known some of them. I know that some of them do believe in possession. Mm-hmm. But what I will get is they're not mentally insane. So they'll tell me that there is a psychosis here. There is something medical here. No, this is something emotional counseling can handle, or move them on to meds. Or I get they're completely lucid. We don't believe that they're suffering, even if they're having paranormal activities. And even if they think that they're being punched and attacked and things of that nature, a actual psychiatrist or psychologist will be able to say, well, it's not because of an illness. So once I get that, that's all I get. And I'll run with that, you know.
Sure. That must be interesting to hear from a psychologist, though, of, you know, that they are on board, not necessarily in terms of a diagnosis, but just in conversation of, yeah, I believe that sometimes there is possession going on.
Well, there's a lot of actual study that has taken place recently called spirit therapy. Mm-hmm. So, and more along the lines of MPS, multiple personality
disorder. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So even if they don't have actual possession, if you treat each individual as a spirit, so to speak, and putting that spirit to ease and treat that spirit, people end up living much more happier and productive lives. So,
yeah.
Now, having said that, is that a belief? No, possibly not necessarily, but it is opening more the academia's eyes. And, you know, there's a Dennis Rader, Dr. Dennis Rader, is a I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. I don't know what he's a doctor of. However, mm-hmm. he has been doing studies more along the lines of psychokinesis, ESP, things of that nature. But you know, it all bleeds together. And one of the things that he said in a seminar I went to watch was there 0.03% of all of academia has ever been applied to studying the supernatural.
Sure.
I mean, it just doesn't exist. So if you look at it, I mean, you know, we've mathematical equations created, you know, told us there's the God particle, right? And they built a, billion-dollar collider over there in Europe,
yeah,
just on mathematical equations. Yet people are having these experiences we're not studying.
How often do you think it is that people are, and I'm not saying, they're having a major need for an exorcism or they're in a very low state of it, but they are simply being told, you know, you have this disorder, take this medicine and your brain will kind of calm down a little bit. And yes, it may help with it, but how often are people possessed or have some sort of attachment to them and they're just being treated as if this is just a mental illness.
Well, there's no real statistic on that.
No.
It's all conjecture, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just wondering what your opinion is on that.
My opinion is, I would say that maybe as high as 20%.
Wow.
There's Archbishop from Georgia that thinks it's more like 90%, right? Mm-hmm. But there's another Archbishop that thinks it's not, it's maybe 2-3%.
Sure.
It's all opinion. We don't have eyes or ears into that world. You know, they're not our cases or studies. But yeah, it happens. We know that it happens. And unfortunately, there's really not a lot that we're going to be able to do about it. So even even if they're diagnosed with a disorder and they are directed to take medications, and we still think there are cases where we still think that they are actually dealing with possession, you know, a priest can proceed forward with diligence. Being very careful with exorcism, but that patient must continue taking the meds. The priest cannot, will not tell the client to stop their medical treatment. So
does that, and I, in no way am I ever suggesting someone stop taking their meds. I am very pro take your meds.
Yeah.
But does someone who is medicated, does that make it easier or more difficult for your, in your opinion, to treat someone spiritually for a possession? Does the medicine help keep things away, keep things down? Obviously, it should help to have them live a better life, but does it make it more difficult to exorcise something out of them, or does it have any effect at all?
So I've read two cases and have two conversations on this, and it goes both ways. There's one conversation that is the patient is more malleable, right? Mm-hmm. They're more susceptible to influence. There's the other conversation that is they may be open to influence. However, that influence doesn't stick. So and in the two cases that I read, both being medicated, that was the different conclusions of the different priests. So the two priests I spoke to about it had, you know, each their own opinion too. I've personally never interacted with it. I haven't. I've identified somebody who I think needed to be on meds. I got the concurrence. They went on meds and they were not treated for exorcism or demonic oppression.
Okay.
Not. So, but yeah, it's a fine line.
Sure.
It's a legal line.
Yeah.
It's a terrifying line.
Yeah. And even beyond that, I mean, it's someone's life, obviously, and you got to tread very carefully as to where you go down and how that's handled. Let me ask you this, because there's a lot of, obviously, ghost hunting is common today as finding a McDonald's, it seems. There's tons of people out there doing it. Tons of people out there some with very careful and cautious ways of doing it. Some just, hey, I got this piece of equipment. Let's go see what it does. And willy-nilly trying to talk to the dead. Is there, or how dangerous, I should say, is ghost hunting with various types of equipment, all the way from a Ouija board, all the way up to, you know, collecting EVPs, ghost boxes, insert device here that somehow seems to get you communication with the other side. Are all of those types of devices and tactics created equal, and you have just the same risk associated with using a Ouija board versus a ghost box or something, or are there different levels of danger depending on what one is doing?
Well, it's as far as the devices themselves, it's how you use the device. So I'm gonna go with your analogy that they're all created equal.
Okay,
but it's you're, when you're ghost hunting, you're opening up yourself to interacting with whatever's on the other side, and you don't know what that that thing is going to be. The more powerful the entities are, negative entities. So there's a very good chance that you're interacting with something that is negative. That's not to say that you don't interact with human spirits, and ghost hunting can be fun. I used to enjoy it a lot, but and there's fun ways to do it. And in biblical tense, it's called necromancy. You're not supposed to interact with the spirits, but if you read through it, you're not supposed to ask them for favors or get intel from them. You're actually supposed to challenge spirits. And there's passage to that. But so as far as a moral aspect of it, I don't think that it's necessarily moral. It's fun. People do it. People, especially around Halloween, everybody wants to go out and have a good scare, but they need to be able to learn. They need to know the dangers. And one of the dangers is you're going to bring something home. That's the first thing that typically happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, you can see a ghost. Yes, you can get EVPs. Yes, you can get touched or pushed or see things pushed over and things. You know, that's the fright. That's what everybody's looking for. But the first real danger is bringing something home. That's more common than not. But the spirits will typically stick around no more than 2-3 weeks, and then they leave. The next danger is, yes, you're opening yourself up, giving something permission to interact with you, but also how much permission you give that is paramount to how much interaction you're going to receive. So if you're saying, spirit, come interact with me however you want, well, that spirit could jump you. Partial possession, temporary possession is a real danger. Then, of course, if the spirit doesn't like where they're at, they can attach themselves to you, and now you've got something hanging on you for an extended period of time. So it's all in the permissions that you give, and that's the spirit board, that the Ouija board everybody's terrified of, because you're giving something permission, tacit permissions, but you're also wanting to move that penchant, right, that little heart-shaped thing, and you're giving the spirit permission to work through you. So now you're giving the spirit permission to jump you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then, of course, a lot of people don't shut it down or know to shut it down, let alone how to. When you're talking to something and want them to talk into a recorder, it's much less likely you're going to be physically attacked or jumped, because you're not given that permission. But people still do in the ways that they talk. Okay. So it's how you approach it, I suppose.
Obviously, the level as to which you've gotten into this is very deep and very powerful and meaningful to a lot of people. And you were brought there. You were driven there in a very personal way in 1997. Can you explain a little bit more about what happened with your wife and you and that demonic attack that took place in your world?
So, yeah, and I'm going to drag this out a little bit, because I'm going to share a case with you.
Okay? Sure.
We were wanting a large family. I'm in love. I said, okay, whatever.
Sure. What's 20 kids?
Yeah, exactly. Well, she had a good target of 7. We had 2, son and daughter, and we were trying to have more while she continued to have miscarriages.
Sure.
During that time, she also started seeing an entity. Now, most would call this the Hat Man. It is a shadow person that is a person that's blacker than black. You can't see any features, and they are not a shadow on the wall. They're like a 3D shadow standing in front of you. And this person, Chris, described as having a cape and a top hat, shorter top hat, not quite a fedora. And it would walk across the room. It would stand in the closet and stare at her. And it seemed to happen. Every time that happened, she seemed to have a miscarriage.
Okay.
So, and yes, we ended up performing. She was not possessed, but we believed that she was being attacked. And we performed a simple exorcism on the home. Multiple, actually. And ended up stopping it. Unfortunately, she did have lasting health conditions, and we didn't have any more than the 2 children.
Sure.
God, we only have 2 children, but that's just me talking. Obviously, I'm upset, right?
Yeah.
Something attacked my wife. My life. And so I actually started looking into this, and yes, I came across the legend of the Hat Man, but this is not the Hat Man. This is not. I've actually ran into this demon a few times, and it seems to go up and down the I-35 corridor. And I know that sounds strange, but there is the transaction of demons jumping by infection, and it can happen. So the whatever means is traveling, it actually goes up and down the corridor. So I've had cases down into Oklahoma, Texas, up into Kansas City, Nebraska, Missouri, up in that area. Mm-hmm. And each of these cases with this particular demon, the woman is pregnant and ends up having a miscarriage. So we, I don't think it's Balak, but I have, and I'll get there. I do have the name of it, but it's really strange. So fast forward, this one particular case is actually in Oklahoma. I'm not going to say where to protect the innocent.
Sure.
She sent me a picture, and it's a picture of this shadow entity full on standing there. Mm-hmm. So I go down and, I start the investigative process, and there's multiple interviews, and it's a 2.5-3 hour drive one direction, and I'm going down sometimes twice a week and to talk to this family. And one of the first things that they noticed is that every time I walked into the house, the clock stopped. All the clocks hanging on the wall stopped. And they checked batteries, they actually replaced the clocks, and time had even passed quite a few visits before they told me about this. It was quite the thing, so I started documenting it.
Yeah.
No specific time, and didn't matter what type of clock, could be digital, it could be analog, could be, there's even a wound clock, mechanical, and it would stop. They would all stop when I came in. During the interview process, multiple EVPs were recorded. One of them, I mentioned Psalms 93, and then the guttural tone, I get a response saying, yeah, try that. But this family is really unique. So they live in a residential area that's rural, and this is an area where 5-acre lots were set out for single home use, and they're double wides and single wides on these properties. The gal moved in and had her home built and moved in. And then she's walking down the street and she sees her sister walking down the other way, where her sister just moved in 2 months before. And they're actually kind of close, but they never told each other. So they have both moved in. And then there, another sister, which they don't interact with very much, moves in further down the street. And the way that they're patterned is their homes are actually in a triangle, which is kind of unique. And then they actually have a brother who is, and if I recall correctly, he's actually from a different father, so they didn't really know him well. He was actually in the same location before any of them were, further on down, the block. And so all four of them coalesced without talking to each other to purchase properties, build homes or have homes transferred there, and to live out their lives. So I got really curious about that. And one of the things that we find often with demonic activity is there's tethers. There seems to be a spider web of events. A lot of exorcists will call it layers. There's a lot of layers to it. And that you really want to go through the investigation and find all these layers to get as much intel as possible. So I started investigating the property, and come to find out, this area was Indian land. Most of Oklahoma is.
Yeah.
But in the early 20th century, a conspicuous landowner, the gentleman who had at one time owned more land than anybody else in the continental U.S., he actually took possession of this land, which was only supposed to be passed down through traditional native bloodlines. But the he convinced this young native that he'll be wealthy if he kills his father, takes possession of the land, and then sells it to him. And they carry this out. And it's not discovered for a few decades, but so for a few decades, he actually lived on the very spot where these four are now living. Come to find out, it's their great-great-grandfather. So his farm, and he even had a railhead. It was such a big ranch. He even had a railhead that came up. You could see traces of this old rail bed still there. He ends up getting killed by his own train, stepped out in front of it, tripped, the train ran over him, killed him.
Wow.
After he died, it was discovered what had happened, and he had already been losing his it was a deck of cards. He had, not deck of cards, house of cards, house of mirrors. He kept leveraging loans upon loans to buy land. So he'd get a loan to buy this land and then get another loan to buy, you know, against that to buy another set of property. So, well, as soon as the money, you know, started struggling, he ended up losing almost everything. And this was the last piece of property he owned. When he died, the murder conspiracy was discovered. And the son ended up going to prison. And he was so upset, he ended up cursing that property. He and not just him, there were some others involved. And I don't want to drag down any native tribe. I'm not going to name a tribe.
Sure.
But they did absolutely perform a curse. Now, additionally, come to find out, this client, the woman who's being affected, is suffering from multiple sclerosis. And she's actually seeking, she's getting a treatment that's an alternative treatment. I mean, she's getting traditional treatment plus an alternative treatment from a doctor who is tricking her body into thinking her body's pregnant. The hormones apparently that are generated during a pregnancy is good to manage multiple sclerosis.
Okay.
That's the easiest way I can explain it. And I couldn't explain it any further.
Sure.
The doctor ended up, during the duration of my investigation, the doctor ends up committing suicide by jumping off a skyscraper downtown. He was being investigated as a crack, so there's extenuating circumstances, but her treatments ended up stopping, right?
Yeah.
So I'm convinced that there is absolutely demonic activity here. I do think that it was a curse that was opened up the opportunity for the demon to come. I do think that it's this demon that affected my wife that got me into this to begin with. And I'm gearing up to, and I think that it's more powerful than what I'm going to be able to deal with. I do think that there's a pulse of possession. One of the things that this client describes in the presence of this demon is her body and bones shake as if you're in the at a concert where they're doing a bass drum.
Sure.
It's being kicked, or, yep, you know, bass guitar at the lowest string. This, yeah, the vibrations just go through her, ultra low frequencies to just vibrate her. She can almost hear it, but it's a feeling. When I'm setting up to conduct what, you know, I call a discernment, she's talking to one of my investigators, and they're both older ladies. And they're just, I jokingly call it henpecking, but you know, they're just talking. And then you hear in a soft woman's voice, a third voice come over the top. And there's only three of us in the room. A third voice comes in over the top, says, "Erigus demonis." So what that is Latin for bear demons.
Okay.
And then following that, and I can actually send you this soundbite. Following that is a very low rumble. and it's just a sound. So that's the demon introducing itself to me. And, you know, of course, I didn't hear it at the time. I heard it at a later time. There was something else that happened. I forget what it was that made me go back and listen to that audio. Yeah, I have audio running at all times.
Sure.
We did catch additional pictures. We did catch what I believe is a different shadow entity moving across the room. During that night, actually, they owned one of the sisters owned a trailer home that they rented. The elderly couple both died there, and we actually stayed in that mobile home. It was empty at the time, and that thing was so full of paranormal activity. I was when we had gone through our our discernment and went to bed, I was laying there in my on my air mattress. Something was poking me on the forehead all night, kept waking me up. I went ahead and rolled cameras there because they said that they thought it might be haunted, and doors are opening and closing, cabinet doors opening and closing. You hear disembodied voices, you know, one of them, "Help me," stereotypical. So I ended up performing a simple exorcism on that place, as well as funeral rites, to try to help move people on. Now, at this time, I conclude, and I have my evidence, I am reaching back through, and I'm working for the Second Order of St. Michael, Order of Exorcists, with Archbishop File as the chief exorcist out in Brea, California. I reach out to him with the evidence, and he's in agreement that a full exorcism needs to take place. So we start talking to a young bishop out of Atlanta, Georgia. At the same time, I get contacted by the History Channel, who wants to come follow me. They had a TV show that was being piloted, and it was, but I guess I can share it. It's Jimmy Church, I'm sure you've heard of him, was the talent of the TV show. And they wanted to call it The Unexplained, ended up calling it Breaking Mysterious. It did air on the History Channel all over. Had a really neat time. But the thing of it is the whole premise of the story was things that you wouldn't normally know. People know about the priests and the bishops who perform exorcists, but they don't know the people who do the back work. So they wanted to come follow me, and they wanted to coalesce on an exorcism, and we were going to use this case for that TV show. Mm-hmm. Well, the person said okay, but then they started getting cold feet. The client got cold feet. And this is typical. You know, oftentimes leading up to an exorcism, a client would get cold feet.
Yeah.
So there was a lot. Anytime you're dealing with a church, there's a lot of politics, and it doesn't matter what religion. It doesn't. There's always politics.
Sure.
So it got to a point where I just told the TV show, you know, go do Atlanta. They got people down there you can do the show on. They said no, they wanted to do it with me. So they came to Wichita, Kansas, and followed me around for a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. That bishop was so pissed off. He wrote me a 7-page slam letter, handwritten and front and back. And just slamming me. So I reached out to the Archbishop. Archbishop didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I ended up, that's how I ended up going, finding Archbishop File. Archbishop Cloud. Long story short, I ended up performing the exorcism myself down there on that place. And it was dry, absolutely dry. There was no activity. There was no emotions. There was nothing happening. And to this day, that house has not had any type of supernatural activity. So what happened? Well, I'm convinced that because she was no longer receiving that treatment, tricking her body to think that it was pregnant, that demon just moved on, that it's gone. There's nothing there for it to take. There's no life force for it to take.
Sure.
So that was probably, back to all the strings that connect everything. I have other you know, I had a case that was connected to Zach Baggins. He doesn't know it. I'm not talking to him about it by any means. But, you know, there's always these little lines, these little tethers of how things can be put together. And that case was just, you know, for it to go back to literally started in 1890 when the first possession of that property was deeded. Mm-hmm. It was really, really interesting to go through that.
Let me ask you this, a little bit off of that subject, but when we're dealing with people here, and we were talking earlier about mental illness, and we talk about people in prison, when we talk about people who've done horrible, horrible things, take BTK, for example. Someone like him who had clearly done so many things over and over with intent, was very blatant about it in court when he finally was caught. Is someone like that, is that a mental illness? Is that an evil person? Is that all just within the realms, though, of them just being a shitty blob of flesh and being a bad human being? Or is does it take something demonic and something dark to allow someone, the living person, to do such horrific acts on others?
Well, I think it's both. First and foremost, you know, you're living in the principality, as I mentioned. You're going to have demonic influence around you at all times.
Yeah.
And I mean, to some level, you know, temptations, right? However, that level of influence can absolutely change your psyche. You know, most psychiatrists, you have a socialization process which can develop as well. Mm-hmm. So the world around you can develop that behaviors. Now, you brought up Dennis Schrader. Schrader is the BTK, and he's actually local, right?
I know. I lived in Wichita for 10 years.
Oh, okay.
And my co-host on the other show, Real Ghost Stories Online, still lives there. We both actually were on KFDI for about 10 years. Actually, she was on it for about 20. But
you actually sound extremely familiar.
I was on there for 10 years. Carol Hughes co-hosted another show with me. She was on there for about 20. Yep.
I know who she is. Yep. I actually ghost hunted your studio.
Halloween
special.
On Old Lawrence Road.
Yeah, Old Lawrence Road. Yep. That's right. I also did iHearts and I'm their local creepy guy.
There was weird stuff in that. We can talk about that later. But yeah, I worked in there for 10 years and we have plenty of weird experiences in that place.
So Dennis Rader is actually in an interview stated that when he goes into that mode, a demon takes over.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if he's talking metaphorically or literally, but it is something that we absolutely watch. And when I say we, there's a circle of people in the ministry, you know, people such as myself and actual bishops and priests. And mm-hmm. we even have a Facebook group called The Exorcist Corner mm-hmm. where we share intel. And we actually watch the news. We pay attention. And there are absolutely cases that we have had where somebody has committed murder and it was they had legitimately blacked out and had no psychological activity prior to that or after. They're deemed psychologically solvent, and yet they claim that they have absolutely blacked out. So yes, we do think that people do get possessed and driven to do murder.
Yeah.
And absolutely a serial killer. I met somebody who's not a career criminal, but they're a functioning professional. And I'm convinced that they absolutely are possessed by a demon, that there is a demon in a meat suit walking around. And it's not just me talking because they're an ass. It's their behaviors and the things that they've done, the things that I have observed.
Was it a horrible car dealer in Wichita?
No, geez. With a shirt open and chains down there.
Exactly, yes. Because I've been convinced of that a few times.
That's not a bad analogy. But, yeah, I think that, there's obviously true medical reasons people behave that way. There's sure. true psychological reasons, and you can't discount that. But if you go back to the very beginning of it all with Adam and Eve, you know, and it's that story is really simple. Dad said, look, you want to live in my house, follow the rules. Mm-hmm. You want to do what you want, get the hell out. Well, we got the hell out.
Yeah.
So living in the real world, now we're susceptible to all these influences. So
why is it that the church has been hesitant to engage with exorcisms, especially in the 90s, when you kind of started to get into this? Is there a reason for it? They just don't want to have that view out there of these things being there? Or what is the rationality?
So, you know, it started changing in roughly around 2001 and 2002, and then the church started absolutely getting a lot more involved. And that was in response to the popularity of ghost hunting and the high levels taking place. Now, having said that, prior to that, and even still today, there's some hesitancy. There's a diocese not far from me. Well, Tulsa Diocese. They used to be heavily involved. They had a Monsignor, and this is St. Benedict Monastery, not far from there, that's been involved. But the new bishop doesn't believe demons. They believe in I'll describe it as a metaphoric demon.
Okay.
They're actually tangible. And that's my words. That's not his. No, don't sue me. However, there's a modernism that had been taking place, and you hear Vatican I, Vatican II. Vatican II was a drastic change in the way the church addresses the real world, and not just down to our the way we complete our masses. You know, they weren't trying to do away with the Latin Mass, traditional Latin Mass, but also how we approach the modern world. So there is a modernism of the church. So there's an overall belief that, you know, if you hold on to these older traditions of, you know, the boogeyman spirits, then it's going to push people away. So that's the mantra that they took. And then there's legal connotations too. I mean, the Catholic Church is one of the most sued churches there is. So there's been a lot of suits associated with exorcisms. Now, I do want to clarify something.
Yeah.
Yes, I am absolutely Catholic. I am not associated with the local diocese here in Wichita.
Sure.
In fact, I am actually what's called Old Roman Catholic now. And the better way to, easier way to describe that is it was a spinoff that happened in the 1870s, Old Roman Catholicism, where, again, I'll keep paraphrasing, the church at that time decided to prop up the Pope as basically a deity. And, you know, there's a pretty good sect of bishops like, no, we're not doing this. So it's spun off, and we're actually a bit more progressive, and we're independent, but we do follow the catechisms and give a nod to Rome. And yes, the Roman Catholic Diocese, a Roman Catholic Church, do reach out to me and interact with me, but they just don't admit it.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Just transparency might be a thing to for them to kind of grasp onto. That might make people a little more comfortable with what they like to do. It's like
they learned the lesson, right?
Yeah, it's like we anything in secret. Maybe that's not going to work out so well in terms of attracting people. When it comes to things, you know, like that when the church is reached out to, is it difficult if someone today is having something that they suspect may be a possession, maybe something demonic going on today? A lot of times it's, let's call the local ghost hunting team that we found on Facebook. Is that really the best idea to start digging into something that really could have very deep lying effects on one's life over the next long period of time?
Depends on what you're after. If you're curious and you're, you know, wanting to get evidence and things of that nature, a ghost hunting team are probably more attuned to that. Just know that when they do come, the activity will get more active. I mean, it's going to get worse. It will. Maybe not right away. It may take a couple of weeks, but it will get worse. Because, again, they're given those permissions to come into your home for anything on the other side. So that way, so then I always, you know, tell people, be careful who you invite into your home. You know, get some references. make sure that they either can shut it down or shut it down if needed, or have access to somebody who can. Then if you're really just wanting it gone and you're scared and bad things are happening, call the diocese office. You don't call a priest, you don't call a church. You actually have to call the diocese office and be open and transparent. Say, hey, I have paranormal activity happening in my house. I would like to talk to a priest about this. And they will absolutely put you in contact with the priest charged with taking those type of calls. And that priest may actually hand off to somebody that they work with, somebody like me or who knows. But every diocese is to have an exorcist priest. Even the one in Tulsa that I mentioned is supposed to have one. And give them a chance to take a look at it. They're a lot more open and transparent. The local diocese in Wichita is actually very active in it. Mm-hmm. This really, really heartwarming to see the priests come out. They call me. Anytime somebody calls me direct, the first thing I do is say, call the diocese. And the diocese has been responsive. The priests have come out, they've blessed the homes multiple times trying to get rid of it. If that doesn't work, they've escalated to the local exorcist, and he's come out and performed exorcisms on behalf of the diocese. I typically go to places where either they're too scared to call the Catholic Church, which a lot of people are terrified to call them. It's the Catholic Church. It's the church's fault. It's not the people's fault. It's the church's fault.
Sure.
I've been contacted by a lot of priests who didn't want to interact with the bishop for whatever political reasons. But for the most part, when I'm dispatched, it's because they're not part of the Catholic Church. They don't really want to interact. What they do is they go to our website, or they know somebody, or there's by reference, I get involved. But I actually try to, come on, it's a charity. I go broke driving around talking to everybody and help them.
Sure.
But I do try to steer it to the local diocese as much as possible.
When it comes to a location that has had traumatic, horrible things happen in it, obviously, a lot of times people are like, ooh, it must be haunted. Sometimes there are stories of activity happening in locations like that. An exorcism can be performed on a property. It doesn't always have to be on a person, correct?
Correct.
Now,
and an object.
Now, when it is something that is like that, is there literally demonic forces just lingering, hanging out in those settings? Is it some sort of energy that is there that's just it's basically been implanted there because of the actions of what one horrible person did? What are you exercising in a location where there's something clearly, dark going on there?
Well, first, back to you have to figure out what it is that's there. So there are multiple reasons and multiple things that could be there. There's you call Resident Evil, right? You've heard that term. So there's a Resident Evil that can manifest due to all the negative activity going on by people within that location.
Sure.
This negative energy ends up building and manifesting in its own identity that can absolutely kill people. I mean, it can tear people down, and you'll have all the paranormal activity or poltergeist activity, as people like to call it now. And it's an energy that was created simply by people, human emotion, and there's not a real good way to actually take care of something like that. It's got to be, and it's kind of funny. Each case that I've come across this had a house full of teenagers going through puberty. And so you let in as much light as possible. You brighten the atmosphere. You keep the emotions down. Counseling. I can't stress that enough.
Yeah.
And professional counseling.
Yeah.
And, you know, if sage makes somebody feel better, sage can help, or you don't have to use sage. There's other incense. So there's remedies of that nature that you can do to something that is manifested like that. There are nested demons. There's one in Newton, Kansas. And having been here, I don't know when you're here, but you may recall in Newton, Kansas, there's a young man who grabbed a shotgun and went and shot his father, who's a beloved teacher in a grocery store when he was working there during the summer. Well, that young man was living in this twin home that was built in the 1910, mm-hmm. and has actually had traumatic activity for decades. And the family who owned it is actually, one of the sons was a Protestant priest, another son was a Methodist priest, another son was in seminary to become a Catholic priest. And the local diocese actually told them to get a hold of me, of all things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was an extremely active case. There is two suicides. There's the murder I mentioned. And there is another murder where a toddler was unfortunately shot and killed with a shotgun. We stopped counting at roughly 11 abandonments that they had on record. People just leave their stuff there and leave. The South Newton Police has on reports, not just in cases, investigations, and video of the doors, exterior doors opening on their own, nobody home. So it's a well-documented demonic activity happening in this home. And so they reached out to me because dad had died. There was a rental home. They bought it from Bethel College back in the 70s. It used to be a kind of a dorm for faculty. And they bought it, turned it into a rental, and all this activity started happening. And they got a hold of me. It's kind of funny. The first day we pulled up, I'm bringing a psychic with me and somebody to video it all. And we noticed the dormers. So I was already told nobody lives there. No, and the water shut off. The electricity shut off. They didn't want anybody to live there. Mom is in there starting to, she's about to enter hospice. They wanted this house taken care of and before it moved on to somebody else's ownership.
Yeah.
So she was meeting me out there, right? So I pull up, it's a twin home. So I pull up in one driveway, she's in the other. And when we pulled up, we noticed the dormer windows, one's dark, one's light. The light one is light because the mini blinds are shut.
Okay.
So I, being a gentleman, go over to talk to you. The little old lady help her out of the car.
Yeah.
And the young man that was with me came running up. He says, Hey, I just saw somebody look out of that window. And I look up and I see the mini blinds, like somebody had used two fingers to open them shut.
Oh God.
So I'm like, okay. So, there's somebody squatting here.
Yeah.
I got the keys from the lady. I opened up the front door, made a beeline to the back door, and it's deadbolted. It's still shut. It's deadbolted. There is no basement. There's a cellar you enter from the outside.
Yeah.
But no basement. So I go running upstairs and I get hit with a fear I've never felt before. The type of fear you taste metal.
Uh-huh.
At that moment, at a desk, and I'm talking an old solid wood desk that's 3 feet by 5 feet by 3 feet high, gets tossed across the room. And they say that I was actually in there for up to 15 minutes. They didn't actually time it, but they're certain I was in there for up to 15 minutes. 30 seconds passed for me before I was back out that house. So I don't know what happened there. But yeah, that is a nested demon. And unfortunately, and the story goes on, but unfortunately, it's still there. That home was not cleansed.
Is it still being rented out?
Yes.
Wow. I don't think you having that experience there, is there anything that would ever bring you back into that place if somebody said, please investigate this further with us?
Well, yeah, actually. So something that's strong, it's kind of fun. I left that day, that evening, we interviewed her. I left that evening ready to come back. I got a call from a psychic out on the West Coast. I had never met her, had no idea who she was. She said that she had a vision that, you heard me say, mentioned Nephilim, that there is a Nephilim in this location. And the reason why she was calling me was because if I brought my daughter, and she thought that it was convinced I was going to bring my daughter in there. If I brought my daughter in there, it was going to attack her. She wanted to be warn me.
Yeah.
So she knew about the house. Of course, she's sharing things with me that she knew about me that really blew my mind. But having said that, I did go back with the team, and we did get our evidence. We did approach the local diocese. There's actually, at the time, an exorcist in Newton at one of the churches, and they did not want to get involved. So I was scheduling the archbishop to come in from California when the mother passed, and so the property went into probate and ended up being sold at auction. So we never got back in there. I would go back in, but I would go back in with reinforcements, obviously.
I mean, is there locations that really just that can't be cleansed? There's just been like the power that there is. There's no human, no matter what their credentials, no matter what church they're coming from, no matter what experience they have, that there's just nothing that's going to be able to go against it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We don't pick fights with demons. You just don't do it. You go into spiritual battle against a demon when you're steered to do so. Yeah. You know, a lot of people, especially ghost hunting groups, they'll like try to go seek out demonic activity at, you know, these nested areas. They'll search for them, and, you know, whether it's actual demon or ghost, or human spirit, but they want that terror. They seem, you know, everybody gets kind of like mirror goggles, right? They're puffed up. They've interacted with a few spirits. They've got some cool EVPs and pictures, and maybe even seen some things. And now they're puffed up and they're ready to go. Mm-hmm. And go into these areas, you know, there's a demon here, I'm going to show us who's boss. Well, they end up getting hurt, and then they call me, and they want me to go take care of it. It's like, why? Leave it alone.
Yeah.
You don't go in there, pick a fight with some. You're talking about ancient beings. I mean, you're talking about, my Latin was corrected by a demon. I mean, you're talking about an entity that can quote every religious text backwards to you if they wanted, in whatever language you wanted to hear it in.
Yeah.
You're not going to challenge a demon in that manner. You just leave it alone. It is the best way. You can't kill it. You can bind it. Bindings only last so long. You can cast it, of course, but the casting, you know, it can come back. And when it comes back with a vengeance. It's pissed, and it's going to come back and do damage. So you don't pick a fight. There are some locations that there's demons there. We know they're there. You know, exorcisms typically don't happen overnight. There's one location in upstate New York where the diocese worked on it for 2 years before they determined it was clean. 2 years of once a week, every week, performing an exorcism. And even after they were done, they still went back every other week, then every 3 weeks, then every month.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to your point, there are places that are so demonic, you just leave them alone. Burn it down. Put a fence around it, you know?
Yeah, there's just so much where it's beyond. It can the same be said for people as well, that sometimes they are just too far gone in what they've done, and that they're not necessarily sitting there, you know, spitting pea soup, but they are just so far gone in their darkness that, I mean, and this may be, here's another example of, I like throwing local examples your way because you know them, the Carr brothers. That would be, I look at that case, and if people are not familiar with this horrible massacre where these two men literally broke into a home where some young folks, young adults were having a party. They ended up forcing the couples to have sex with the incorrect partners, ended up taking them out, long story short, to a field and executing all of them. One of them survived being shot in the head. But these people have never shown remorse whatsoever for their horrific acts, and the brutality goes far beyond what I just summarized there in an eggshell. Look at it, like Wichita Massacre, I think, is the Wikipedia entry if you want to read more about it. But someone like that, where you see them, just literally no soul. I mean, just literally no remorse, nothing. They're missing something. Is that a possession? Or are there literally people with no souls, or they've somehow been taken from them at some point, and now they're just shells, and they walk around and do horrible shit?
So the question is, I don't know.
Are they evil? Are people like that?
Well, let's answer yeah, the first question.
Yeah.
Are they redeemable? They're only redeemable if they want to be redeemable. It's all free will.
Are they capable of wanting that, though? And some people, I wonder, are they even capable of it?
Yeah, I think if they, like Coen Brothers' perfect analogy, I don't think if they want it. I think if they absolutely are walking human demons, did they do something to get a demon invited into them and take over? We'll never know.
Sure.
But I do think that there are people who are just simply so evil that they just, they won't be redeemed. They won't ask for redemption. They don't want redemption.
Yeah.
But then again, there are those who have, you're local. You remember the murder and dismemberment in the bottom of a Hispanic club.
I was just looking that up because I couldn't remember the name of the place. I've been there.
It used to be called Rock Island, right?
Yes, yes. I went there when I was looking to meet people because I just worked at the radio. Yeah. I it was like 2006 or so. So it was only like 2 years after the issue or the horrible dismemberment. I went with a ghost hunting group there and we walked around, and I remember walking into that basement of that nightclub by myself, and the lights were off. The only way to get to one of the lights, you had to like really walk into this dark room and find it. And I'm not a very sensitive person. At least I don't, at that time, I didn't think I was at all. I think I'm a little bit now, but there was such a weird, and I didn't even know exactly what happened or where it happened until I walked out of that basement. But then somebody told me, yeah, like all these people were shot and dismembered in this basement of this nightclub. I think it was called like JC's House of Rock or something at that time.
It ended up being a lot of different things.
Yeah, it just kept changing names. Yeah, but it was a weird, weird energy.
Guess what?
What?
That was a sanitarium built in 1928.
Oh my God.
There's originally a poor farm on that corner. So, you know, there's the bowling alley that not too far from there. And for the listeners, this is on the corner of Pawnee and Oliver in Wichita, Kansas.
Yeah.
So there in 1870, a poor farm was built by the Cedric County, and it contained encompassed all, I think, 470 acres. So it was big. And Jester's Creek ran through it. And this in 1928, the county ended up building that building that this nightclub was in as an infirmary, and it was a house. It had tuberculosis huts, went through the Spanish flu, and ended up, and you know, granted the tuberculosis and Spanish flu peaks were not during this period, but it absolutely was built for those purposes. And it ended up being shut down, and the last patients moved out of it in 1948, where they were moved to the new hospital on West Douglas. And then it became, so it had all these deaths associated with it.
Like, yeah.
Dying, dies. I mean, back then it's just, they make you comfortable as hospice, basically.
Yeah.
So you had all those deaths, and the paranormal activity actually was being spoken of. I'm going to date myself. I was going there back in the late 80s, where there's a band by Dead Orchestra playing out there. And a gentleman that I knew threw a beer bottle into that basement. They came flying back out. I was there and I witnessed it. So
it's a weird, have you ever gone into the basement?
No. Once I found out the history. So,
yeah.
I'm wanting to do a production and of these stories and tales that, you end up going outside to find something still there.
Yeah, it's a very, it's a weird layout of a building too. It doesn't, it doesn't make a lot of, like, you go in there like, what is this? And it's just weird. It's a weirdness vibe to that whole building.
It's burnt down now.
Oh, it's gone.
Yeah, yeah. So in fact, you can even go on Cake They interviewed me explaining what the building was and the history of it. So there's a little story spot on Cake. And he bought it for like 40 grand in an auction about 15 years ago. Could never make a go of it. It kept sitting vacant. And we think that somebody, it was a real cold night. We think somebody, you know, broke into it and tried to light a fire to keep warm and set on fire. So tragic loss of history.
Yeah. My goodness. Yeah. No, that I was going to bring that up. So I was going to ask you if you knew anything about that case as well. I just couldn't think of the Rock Island name. I was searching Wichita murder basement of nightclub.
Well, here's the thing. I read the court cases and I interviewed some of the family members, and it's documented that there was in the dismemberment, there's possible satanic rituals taking place as either, I mean, the murders itself and the dismemberment was, the murders were because the guy was just nuts. The dismemberment was just to dispose of the bodies. But two of the people that were involved, one of them was known to be a Satanist. Now, fast forward to 20, and I didn't know, I knew about the murders. I didn't know about this. Fast forward to 2014, I actually got a case handed to me to go help a mother of an autistic son who's being attacked by a spiritual entity. Further investigation found out that this entity was actually a curse that was sent to attack her, misfired, hurting this child. And the person who sent the curse was one of the ones who dismembered the bodies in the bottom of that sanitarium.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Small world.
Yeah, hey, I've seen you before. So, but you know, back to the redemption.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, one of those persons has absolutely redeemed himself. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, living a productive life, a good life, and has, you know, stands a real chance of going to heaven. You know, it's not my judgment. I don't make the call. But in my opinion, I do think that he has done so. So you can be a bad person and do some really bad things. If you want to change and you want salvation and you seek it, it'll be there. But it goes back to the people who don't want the salvation. What's wrong with them? You know, that's a million-dollar question. If you can answer it, let me know.
That wraps up our conversation with Timothy Earle. A big thank you to him for joining us and being a part of this extended interview today. Very fascinating conversation. And thank you for supporting the show and keeping us on the air. We would not exist without it. Until next time, for all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.